My name is Isaac Guinai. I'm 32 years old. It's the 19th of July, 2021, and I'm recording this from Birmingham, England, and I'm here interviewing Dr. Alison Arwady about the Epidemic Intelligence Service. I think that's my phone, my dad's. Let me turn it off. Apologies.
Hi, I'm Alison Arwady. I am 44 years old. Today is July 19th, 2021. I am in Chicago, Illinois, and I am interviewing with Dr. Isaac Guinai, who the two of us either are currently or were previously in the Epidemic Intelligence Service with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
So, Alison, let's start there. You have had more time between your time in EIS or the Epidemic Intelligence Service than I have. Would you like to kind of just briefly go over what that entails and what you're doing with yourself nowadays?
Sure. So I'm a doctor, first and foremost. I am internal medicine and pediatrics. And even before I'd gone to medical school, I actually got really interested in public health. And I took an epidemiology class, and then I took a history of public health law and tuberculosis versus HIV, and I was really sold. I, even though I had made the decision to go to medical school and I love taking care of patients, I just really, really liked the large picture thinking in public health and the ability to pull in my interests in history and my interests in ethics and my interest in systems. And so when I finished my medical training, I did my school and residency. I did the chief residency year, you know, that was a very clinically focused. I then made the decision, applied for and was accepted to CDC's EIS, or Epidemic Intelligence Service Program. It's a two-year postdoctoral program. So folks who are in the program are physicians who are fully trained at that point, or they're epidemiologists who are PhDs, veterinarians, other sort of postdoctoral. And the idea, which really appealed to me and why I decided to do this, was that I knew I liked public health in the academic sense. I really wanted to work on the ground in a public health department. I wanted to take the medical training that I had and really see what it looked like to apply it in a prevention lens and apply it, you know, in a community lens. I also had a big interest, which I know you share, Isaac, in international health, and was very interested in outbreaks. If I hadn't done EIS, I would have done infectious diseases in terms of my specialty. And I really, you know, decided to sign on and do this. So it's a two-year program. And I chose to be a CDC employee, but assigned to the Illinois Department of Public Health in Chicago. And so I spent really those 2 years working primarily on outbreaks and learning how to be a public health physician and leader. So I worked across Illinois. I worked in schools, prisons, hospitals, community settings on a whole range of diseases, really learned a lot about how to actually do public health and outbreak response. And then because I was part of the EIS, had the opportunity to be in Saudi Arabia as part of the MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome outbreak, with a team from CDC. And then in particular, two different deployments with CDC to Liberia during the Ebola outbreak in 2014-15, both at the very beginning before there were a lot of resources and later. So, you know, EIS for me was just my favorite thing ever in terms of really finding my people, finding the thing that I wanted to do for the rest of my life, like meeting this cadre of folks who were interested in exactly the same things I was interested in, and really wanted to, you know, make public health here in the US and around the world like all it could be and more. So it's been a really important like personal network for me, as well as very clearly what launched my professional career in the non-clinical sense.
And so since then, that was 2014 that you finished?
I started in 2013. So it would have been, is that right?
2015.
Yes.
Yeah. So since then, do you want to just kind of quickly talk us through what you've been doing in Chicago?
Yeah, sure. So one of the things is, because I had worked on Ebola as part of the outbreak, there was just this sort of by chance, I kind of knew more about Ebola than a lot of people who were working in Illinois. And so had gotten to know in between my two international deployments for Ebola, spent all of my time working in Illinois on Ebola preparedness and response, and had gotten to know a lot of the other people in the hospital setting and in the public health setting. And so specifically the Chicago Department of Public Health, which is a city Department of Public Health, as opposed to the state, which is where I had been assigned with the CDC. They were looking for a chief medical officer. And that is a role that was a very big role to move into after EIS, in that it was taking my medical knowledge, but it was also, I had been very focused on outbreak response when I was at the state and with CDC. And this was moving much more into some of the structures of public health, thinking about emergency preparedness, thinking about behavioral health, thinking about, you know, how you actually operationalize work in a health department. And I had the role of being really the primary medical advisor and decision maker with obviously a huge team. And so moved into that chief medical officer role at the Chicago Department of Public Health, just learned a ton in that setting, was in that role for about 5 years. And then in the summer of 2019, I moved into the acting commissioner role. So that's when really I oversee the department, the Chicago Department of Public Health. I was actually finally confirmed as the commissioner 4 days before we activated for COVID in January of 2020. And so my entire experience really in the leadership role at the Chicago Department of Public Health has been extremely influenced by COVID, but it also, in terms of sort of timing and right place, it was, if there was going to be a challenge that big that was going to come as I moved into this, you know, really pretty significant leadership role, it was a space that largely because of EIS and everything that had come over, I felt very comfortable in my expertise in. I felt like I had a good colleague of networks across the country to turn to. It's certainly been a journey. It's been a learning experience, but it's been really good. And I mean, it's been hard, as you know. There's nothing, you know, our team here has just been working like around the clock for 16 months and more, but there's absolutely nothing I would rather be doing. And it's, you know, I really feel grateful to CDC and the EIS program for kind of setting me on the pathway that was the perfect match for, you know, me and my personality and what I'm interested in.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, a lot of people within the public health community, certainly, but also, you know, I've spoken with a lot of people outside the public health community in Chicago who've said that we couldn't have been more lucky to have you at the helm at this time in particular. You know, like all of your experiences to date really did set you up for to be the right commissioner at the right time.
You never know what you're going to get. And I think, you know, in some ways, I know what I know, and I know what I don't know, and I know how to find out what I don't know, and I'm confident in this space. Like, nobody ever knows the answers all the time, right? Especially with COVID and a new pandemic and what is it. But I do think I had a lot to sort of look back on and take from. And, you know, as you know, approaching a very tiny foodborne outbreak is essentially the same as approaching a pandemic, yeah. Like in terms of the steps and what you need to think about. And so, you know, was I the best person? I don't know, but I was the person who was here. And I had a team that I knew well and trusted. And I do think we have come through this much better than we certainly might have. So I've been thankful for all the preparation I had for it.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk much more about the last 2 years and the COVID response in particular, but also, you know, some of the other fascinating outbreaks that you've worked on both in EIS and subsequent to that. But I also wanted to kind of go right back to the start and see if there were things, you know, you talked us through, I think, kind of your pre-med school study, starting to study public health and history of medicine. But was there a sign early in childhood, or what was it kind of in your upbringing or schooling years where you that started to lead you towards maybe health was something you felt was important, or maybe, you know, you had the skills to respond to stressful situations very well? Can you think of any early experiences that were formative that way?
Yeah, so I'm someone who has always been interested in a very wide range of things, and I like to think about big picture questions. And I think when I was in high school, I was lucky enough to attend a math and science high school for half of the day and had really good early exposure and really challenges in the science arena. I knew that I liked that, knew that I was good at it. And then when I was in college, I actually felt very secure in my science, math and science background. And I actually, my major, my concentration was in history and literature because I wanted to, you know, kind of grow my ability to write and communicate. And I've always been interested in history and how we sort of learn from what has come before and think about how we talk about whatever is now is very influenced by the moment we are in, not just, you know, not just what's before. And so when I was coming out of college, I thought I maybe wanted to be more of like a science writer. I had done a lot of travel guide writing and updating. And I didn't really know about public health, like as a field, until after I was already out of college. But really, once I found it, I was really hooked and knew that I wanted to combine. So I think, you know, I've not had the most direct path. And I think that has, you know, in some way, I mean, I wouldn't have done it any differently. But in some ways, it's having the chance to kind of try a few different things and take pieces from that, I think has been helpful.
And before we kind of delve too deeply into the last 18 months or so, semi-related, like I know you mentioned you're somebody with very diverse interests, like you're a history tour guide in Chicago, and I've seen the incredible glass sculptures you've made and heard you sing in choirs. How have you balanced not just, you know, EIS and your post-EIS career, but particularly like in a pandemic where you're the person in the news every day? How have you balanced that responsibility and that visibility with managing to do all the things that you enjoy and stay sane and have your personal life outside of your career?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I think, you know, frankly, during a lot of COVID, most of the rest of my life went on hold. And I know that that is true for sort of, you know, the world at large. But I think in my case, it was not only the fact that so many things that I normally love, right, leading the architecture boat tours or, you know, seeing patients in clinic, whatever it is, all of that was on hold. But also there was such a need to be just so focused on like what needed to happen next. And so I really tried and with our staff too, trying to like create at least a little bit of space, right? Like recognizing this was going to be and still is a marathon. And, you know, we were doing stuff 7 days a week for sure at the beginning, kind of for months. And then really saying, okay, Sundays at least, we're going to try to kind of hold and making sure that I was reaching out to people for, you know, support. And then when things were a little bit calmer, also trying to take that moment to recapture some of this. So for example, we're in reasonably good control right now. We're not done with COVID, but I've picked the pottery class back up, right? And I've like, you know, started going hiking and, you know, some of these things that I feel like there's a little more space to do. But I do think in the, you know, with all of the staff, they're trying to be quite specific about you must take time off, right? Even if it's a little bit and a little bit and a little bit, and recognizing that, you know, I need to have that model too. So still working on it. But the other good thing is that luckily, like, I still love this stuff, right? Like in some ways I absolutely, you know, there's nothing I like do, you know, when I take the subway, you know, down in the morning to work, like my favorite thing is to like read the CDC, you know, literature, what's the latest on COVID and look up the article. And I still find it like intellectually really interesting and thinking about how to take the science. And then my job is often to translate that like to the community is something I just enjoy thinking about. Like it's fun for me. And so in that way, like if it were not fun, I probably would not like have lasted right in this position. Both interesting, important, but also for me, just it is something I love.
And I think EIS does in some ways prepare you to delve really deep into things and commit yourself to it for a period of time. And you know, one of the good things I think about public health in general, but certainly about EIS, is that sometimes it can be quite episodic. You have a project, you have an outbreak, you work on that, you try and see it through to some form of completion, and then you can, maybe there's a gap between the next one, maybe you're lucky enough to experience a time like that. And so it's encouraging to hear that you're picking some of these things back up and gonna, you know, have hopefully have more of that time in the coming year.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, when I think back to EIS, it is so, you know, you're taught to do outbreak response, at least in the most traditional, the kind of role that I had. And I was working on such a variety of outbreaks, and each one is going to have sort of its own challenges. And, you know, to sort of come into this space and need to be at some level the voice of some expertise, like even as you yourself are learning, is an interesting challenge. And the very clear need, like you learn really early on that unless you've done true engagement work with, you know, stakeholders, that's the term, but like whoever is being impacted and whatever setting you're in, really like stepping back and saying, let me hear first, let me understand this problem first. And then bringing whatever expertise you have into that. Like if you don't do that well, you're not going to get anything right. And, you know, when I'm thinking about outbreaks, sure, I think about the cases. I always think about these four C's, the cases, which is largely the healthcare system. What's happening with people who are sick? Do we have a safe place for them? You know, second, I think about containment broadly. That's the C of sort of public health, our work of stopping disease from spreading and preventing it. But then the two places it fails are not on what is the health system doing and what is the public health system. It fails on coordination and it fails on communication. And so I'm always trying to think back on like the coordination slash engagement and the communication, both internal and external. And those are always, it doesn't matter the size of the outbreak, where things are going to go wrong. And so trying to keep that like in my mind as where are we having trouble? Where do we need to put more resources? People take for granted that those are the parts. They think we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to do contact tracing. I mean, we do a little bit of that, but it's that structural work that is actually, I think, for long-term success and thinking about what comes past COVID. It's really trying to think long-term and structural if you're going to be successful, not just for like this month, but for like the year and the next 5 years.
Yeah, and I'm struck that maybe the first two of those, cases and containment, are relatively similar across across cultures and across diseases, right? Like, they're pretty absolute, they're pretty scientific, they're pretty measurable, they're pretty objective in some ways. But the coordination and communication seems to be very, very context dependent. And
absolutely.
I'm acutely aware of that now. I'm in the UK and, you know, it's had a very different epidemic to the epidemic in the US. And, you know, I came to the US with a UK experience and in some international experience as well, but it's been kind of fascinating to see how the communication and the coordination are different across cultures. And I wondered how you found that, not just in COVID, but also some of your international work in EIS and before and after that.
Yeah. And I think one of the most, you know, when I was in EIS, you have this opportunity to come into spaces that are very clearly not your spaces, right? So whether you're, you know, when I was working on outbreaks across Illinois and you're moving into an outbreak in a prison setting, that is very much not your setting. But when you do that internationally, it's like even more magnified because, you know, even the CDC, if they're there as part of a response, are there at the invitation of the country and the Ministry of Health. And those are the ultimate decision makers. And again, it is not your job to make the decisions. It is your job to lend support and kind of lend expertise. And depending, I mean, the different, like how it's been really interesting to see these outbreaks, you know, play out in such, I think back to Saudi Arabia, right? Where like, particularly as a woman coming in, with CDC and then even moving out of the cities to some settings that were not used to women having particularly strong voices in decision-making. And do you know what I mean? Like just culturally, it is quite helpful to get dropped into different settings and need to think about how to make sure you're coming at the situation, first of all, with humility and sort of a learning attitude. And then as you sort of learn about that, saying, where can I help fill gaps? How can I make people feel like I'm on that team? And so, you know, and there's all kinds of, all of these issues. I just think doing work outside your regular setting builds those skills in really tangible ways. And so what's different is with COVID, you know, Chicago, you know, as the commissioner of the Chicago Department of Public Health, that is very much my job, right? And so as opposed to like being in this like, oh, I can advise, but somebody's going to make the decision at the end of the day, it was this major decision making that in some ways was very welcome because I could have, like, I didn't feel like I was stepping on somebody else's turf or needing to be really cautious. But on the other hand, like, the buck stops with you, right? Like, and feeling a lot of responsibility to make sure that you are still engaging all of those other groups and learning from them. I mean, that's been a huge part of our COVID response here, saying we're not going to get everything right. A lot of very authentic, you know, community engagement around what do we need to do differently, trying to be very data-driven. But at the end of the day, one of the reasons I love working, particularly at the local level as an American, is that I can make those decisions in a way that doesn't feel, I don't have to worry as much about whether I am appropriately imposing my will. Yeah, exactly. And I want to make sure that will is informed, but it is a different level of responsibility, but one that I think having a lot of opportunity to be in a very different role has been helpful as we've, you know, as I've had to make by far the biggest decisions, you know, that I've ever had to make.
And I know, I of course, you are the commissioner of the Chicago Department of Public Health and the top public health decision maker in a city of 3 million people. But also, I think COVID has really highlighted that, and very much the kind of apex decision maker there, but COVID, I think, has really highlighted that to be effective in public health, you have to influence others to make public health decisions, right? You're not in control of all of the schools. You're not in control of how everybody behaves, but you've had to persuade the public to do that. And, you know, the mayor to do things and the schools department and the prison department. And how have you kind of navigated that space, both now straddling both the absolute decision maker and the I'm still a technical advisor, and you have to listen to me. This is important.
Yeah, I know. Thanks for bringing that up. I think, you know, particularly where you sort of take the national version of this and sort of how politicized this has been in a lot of ways, I do not take at all for granted the fact that here in Chicago, you know, the mayor really came, I think, to trust me and the department early and consistently. We saw a lot of political leaders across the country wanting the public health department to own the difficult decisions, right? The shutdowns, the, you know, requirements, et cetera. And they would distance themselves, right? And sort of say, that's public health over there, and then want to own sort of the reopening, et cetera. And we really, from early on, you know, Mayor Lightfoot here in Chicago was very clear that, of course, there's going to be a lot of competing forces and we're going to talk, but like at the end of the day, first and foremost, we are going to do what is most needed by public health, because that is what's going to save lives. And yes, we're going to think about these economic pieces, but I think the fact that she and I have been out together, have like taken the hits together, have celebrated together, and that we've really, you know, very concretely, I set as a goal that I did not want where there were differences between the city and the county or the city and the state, or there's always going to be differences. I didn't want that to be the story, because I think that brings the politics and, you know, sort of the distrust and the, you know, can we, you know, should I believe what the public health department says if this one says one thing and this one says the other? And so even where we were having, you know, of course, in any, there's big decisions, there's going to be conflict. I think the ability at, you know, between the city and the state, for example, to present a largely unified front and not let the behind the scenes discussions be part of it is critical. And so how do you build that? I mean, I think you come in from a point, again, of reasonable confidence. Like, I felt like nobody knew exactly what was going to happen with COVID, but I did feel confident in my training, but also like that I had a team of people who spend their entire lives thinking about this. And I was very connected through CDC and others to people who had way like decades more of experience than I did. And we weren't going to necessarily always get it right. But I've felt that I certainly, and we certainly had a better chance than the random person in terms of making decisions and suggestions about COVID. And so I think having some confidence and just like, you know, point, like when Italy, right, was really blowing up very early on. I mean, I remember I didn't know the mayor well before this. Like, you know, we didn't meet regularly, and having a meeting with her and basically being like, this is something we have to address like now, like today. You know, I know you don't know me, but here's what this looks like. And her sort of quickly recognizing this, pulling, you know, the cabinet together and like really saying, we're going to go for this, especially at the beginning when, you know, the fact that Chicago and Illinois, thank goodness, were earlier than we might have been to make some of those really, it would have been even worse. So I think it's about just having some confidence and being really honest about what you know and what you don't, because it'll come back and haunt you if you try to say you know things that you're still learning. But where you do know things or where you can predict things, you want to be clear about that so that people have some confidence in your expertise. And it is expertise in terms of, you know, how to best handle this, even while we're all still learning.
Yeah, that kind of critical importance of trust, I think, has been highlighted, you know, throughout this pandemic, but also, you know, presumably in a lot of your work prior to this. And I think there's been a few moments for me in this response when, particularly actually recently around vaccinations, you know, there's a lot of misinformation around, and a lot of my work, as you know, has been in people experiencing homelessness and people living in correctional facilities and people who might rightly have reasons to distrust a lot of systems, but actually have been willing to take, you know, what is a new, very safe and very proven drug, but a new drug, largely on the word of people who they work with and have developed a trusting relationship with. And that's kind of been a really powerful realization for me, just how, without that, we have nothing. We really have nothing as public health professionals. Yes. And I wondered if you'd had kind of experiences from COVID or before COVID where that had gone well or that had not gone well, and how, just illustrating how, you know, how centrally important trust is in everything that we do.
Yeah. And for me, that gets back to the communication, right? If you don't first have good communication, and ideally communication before the outbreak, right? Before the issue. And where I think about, you know, an example is we had really in our emergency preparedness in Chicago had put quite a lot of work into trying to have our hospitals be reasonably connected, sort of around public health preparedness and bringing folks together routinely and, you know, doing exercises. And it wasn't so much the content, although that was somewhat important in the exercises, as the fact that those relationships, and there was sort of an understanding that in a major outbreak, the health systems would sort of look to the health department and want to think about how to collaborate. And some of that had come out of the Ebola work, frankly, right? Where during Ebola in Chicago, there, and I wasn't even, you know, this is when I was at the state, so I wasn't at the Chicago Department of Public Health, but the CDPH, the Chicago Department of Public Health leadership, you know, had really worked with some of our academic centers because people were really nervous about raising their hand and saying, I'm going to be a hospital that's willing to take Ebola patients, right? This was a major, people saw it as a risk to the reputation of the hospital. People were worried about their staff and sort of got, you know, a group of hospitals together to say, we're going to be the Chicago Ebola Resource Network. And together, whatever comes when there are patients, we're going to trade that risk and that responsibility and that cost. And I think having some structure for that, you know, when COVID was surging, you know, very quickly being able to pull together data from every single hospital about how many patients do you have, how much bed availability, what are your ventilators, right? Like, and we had systems in place for that that gave us more of a citywide view clearly than many other places had. And so I think, you know, it comes from a place of having communication and trust and sort of having built that before an emergency, but then also even in an emergency, trying to sort of say, okay, we're meeting, I'm sorry, you know, and this would be outside the hospital, but with community-based organizations, for example, maybe we haven't worked together now, but I think we're in agreement that something needs to be done here. And we want to hear from you. What do you need? And here's what the data shows. Here's where we're, you know, trying to get vaccine, or here's where we're having a hot spot of COVID right now. And we are going to put testing resources in your community. You tell us where, you tell us when, you tell us what that should look like, right? And really trying to be really thoughtful about building some of that trust, where if they say, we need this particular thing done, you then do it, right? And so then the next time there's the ability to grow this. And, you know, we don't have time probably to talk about sort of all the pieces of how we've tried to pull this together, particularly with a race equity lens. But I think that there has been a very different way of approaching the many, many, many partners here. And I'm really conscious of the fact that I'm often not the best spokesperson, right? Particularly where there are, you know, where there are very good historic reasons for lack of trust in government, lack of trust in health, lack of trust in public health. And so the work of thinking about who are your proxies, who can you work with who you know understand public health and want to, you know, share the information about vaccination, for example, you really want to make sure you have built and then not just sort of ask people to help, but funded them and created structures that allow them, you know, in a very neighborhood-based setting where there tends to often be more trust, build that up. And so as we think about preparedness moving forward, it's not just do we have masks on the shelf, which Chicago actually was quite well prepared compared to a lot of places in terms of having stuff, but having the investments to create some of those networks that you will then depend on. You know, you can work on chronic disease stuff in the interim, but if you've got another outbreak or another pandemic, you need a structure that is built on communication and coordination. And that public health infrastructure should exist prior to, you know, prior to really needing it in an urgent situation.
How about times when trust or communication or coordination has not gone super well, you know, whether that's here or whether that's internationally? I imagine the very early Ebola response in 2014 would have been relatively chaotic. And how does that manifest in terms of actually getting public health done?
Yeah. So, I mean, that first Ebola deployment, which would have been in the summer of 2014, you know, I was lucky enough to be on the CDC team that was on the ground really as the outbreak was showing how big it was going to be. And there, while health systems were shutting down and just seeing how kind of quickly overwhelmed any capacity sort of could be. And then recognizing that even though there were a lot of people who knew what needed to be done, there just were not the resources. And you can, you know, and as someone, you know, I was going into hospitals that had, you know, no PPE, no personal protective equipment, or like a pair of gloves that they were like leaving on the table next to the potential Ebola patient, and the healthcare workers are trying, you know, and Ebola is transmitted by touch. Like, you're really, really dangerous. And then seeing these hospital workers, these healthcare workers getting infected, and then they're not being the PPE to take care of the healthcare workers. And just like you, communication, like in the absence of the resources to take care of the cases and do that, you know, do that work of public health is all about, you know, how are you prioritizing this, right? And I felt like my job in a lot of ways was to sound the alarm. This was before the public health emergency of international concern had been announced. And we were a small team with a lot of other folks on the ground. And it wasn't, what do we need to do? It was, this is so much worse than anybody's realized. And getting sort of that message out, you know what I mean? Which is different. Yeah. The sort of CDC message sort of to the international community about get the resources in here, right? Like, this is so bad already and it's going to get worse. And then on the ground, having these conversations where you couldn't do the most basic things that needed to be done. And you can't overpromise something, but you're also trying to solve those problems. But you do see, I mean, like, you know, you saw these communities, even in Liberia, stepping up and, you know, bringing toilet paper to the hospital, right? And bringing, like, you know, drinks and, I mean, trying to do what they could in the absence of, like, these most basic things. And I do think communities, they either they both fall apart and come together, right? Like in any major stressful situation, and an outbreak or a big pandemic is going to be one of those most stressful situations. You're going to see all the cracks. You're going to see all the ways in which we've made decisions as a society that have left us vulnerable. And you are going to see people at every level sort of rising to that occasion. And if you can coordinate that rise, right? The first time I was there, like burned in my brain is some of these doctors, you know, trying to build Ebola isolation wards out of like tarps in the back, right? And then 6 months later being there at a time where it was a much more normal response because there were resources. There were enormous Ebola isolation units and there was testing and there were hundreds of, you know, paid workers that could sort of do the work. I really, you know, I think it's communication, but also you've just got to have the resources. And so just to kind of tie it to Chicago, early on here was so crazy to me to be sitting in Chicago, one of the best resourced like healthcare settings in the entire world, in the richest country in the world, and literally feel like panicked because we were maybe going to run out of ventilators. And it was that same panicky feeling that I had felt most acutely during the situation in Ebola in Liberia, that we knew what was needed and we just couldn't get it. And to have that happen here, I think was the other part that really just on a personal level made me like, that was the most worried. It was the most worried I was even if we know what to do, we just can't get some stuff. And I had never anticipated that feeling so central to a response I would work on in Chicago.
But again, some of the same things that you learn in West Africa, just even bearing witness to the difficulty building trust in those communities. So when they did come, you know, people would get tested, people would go to hospital, people would get vaccinated when the vaccine came.
Yeah, and the necessity of protecting healthcare workers. Like I cannot, like that burned into my brain in a way, you know, Liberia has so few doctors and so few healthcare workers to start with. And you were literally like wiping out the entire healthcare system from a personnel, but also the ability, you know, and more people ended up dying because they couldn't get taken care of after an accident or child, you know, there were like, the whole thing shut down. And so I have, after that, like, never taken like at all for granted, you know, the sort of how strong a healthcare system can be. And when you think about the indirect effects of if that shuts down, I think that's where, you know, those decisions that if you are threatening your healthcare system, not in a theoretical way, but in a way that it could actually be overwhelmed, like we saw happen in settings that were historically really well resourced, that became, you know, the top thing that we do above all things. Like whatever we do to protect that healthcare system, I'll make every hard decision I need to make that happen. Because if you lose that, the indirect effects are just so big. And so, right, there are these things that even if you're seeing it in a small space, I think they burn into your brain as something that is just got to be central to any, you know, any big response after.
Yeah, it's muscle memory, a lot of this stuff. Yeah. And I think the more you do, the more you learn these hard lessons.
Yeah.
I think we just have a few minutes left. And I think I kind of just have one other relatively big question that I wanted to cover. So I know you're very interested in history and both kind of in the grand span of human history, but also, you know, learning from your past experiences and those past experiences of the people you work with and the organizations you work for. I was reading something about the 1918 flu pandemic and how it had affected Chicago. And unfortunately, some of the same divisions that we've seen, you know, citywide, statewide, countrywide, and worldwide, really, with COVID, that the communities that are hardest hit are those communities that are most disenfranchised at baseline. So those communities that are, you know, more poverty stricken and living in close quarters and now very much communities of color. And I was struck by something you said in your last response as well about how moments like large epidemics can really break a society down and really bring a society together. And I think, you know, some of the racial justice riots in the last year and a half as a result of the murder of George Floyd, I think was an example of that, and how kind of public health intersects with this wider societal, you know, the flaws that exist in society at baseline. And I wondered kind of broadly, how much have we learned in the last 100 years, and what's going to be different when inevitably the next pandemic comes, hopefully not for 100 years, but quite possibly sooner. What's going to be the same? What's going to be different? And what should everybody listening be doing to try and make sure that it's not the same old story?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, I mean, you know, I love history, and I have regularly looked back at what Chicago did during, you know, the 1918-19 flu pandemic, as I'm thinking about decisions. And it is in some ways comforting to sort of say, oh, they were thinking about what to do with Halloween too. But it's also, somewhat, you know, these patterns of power, right? Like in Chicago, across the US, who is protected from disease and what those beliefs are about why disease lands in a particular community. That why piece actually does change over time, and yet the outcome is the same. And so, you know, right now, I think in the US and in Chicago, you know, there's such a lens appropriately around structural racism, right? And that, like, for years and years and years and years and years, where people live in Chicago, the opportunities that they've had, which things are in neighborhoods, where healthcare is, but not just healthcare, the education and economic safety opportunities have built up over decades. And this isn't new with COVID, but you see the disproportionate death that has always been there highlighted to an extent that you can't ignore. And so the thing I take sort of as hope a little bit is that we have seen prior pandemics also be the source of major changes in terms of who gets to do what role, who gets to work, who, you know, and if you look sort of over all of human history, like major changes. And I'm really hopeful here that, first of all, we will think that it makes sense where we're thinking about our healthcare spending, not just to spend 1 or 2 cents of every dollar on public health and the rest on sort of the healthcare, the after somebody gets sick, which is important and amazing. But the work of prevention and the work of the really working on these structural inequities, being really honest about them, calling them out, and thinking about what can we do from a policy level, from a systems level, to really improve the environments that people are in. That's not just about opening a clinic in an underserved neighborhood. That's these longer term decisions that don't go on the same timeline as, you know, political elections do, but that I hope that people who really care about their communities, about this country, about this city, are willing to say, what have we learned about the ways we can work? What have we learned about the barriers? What have we learned about, you know, the term essential worker? Are things that we will make different decisions about as a society, because this shows our cracks, as any outbreak does, but it also gives us the opportunity to, you know, fill in those cracks, if you will, with approaches at all levels. And I'm hopeful we're going to do that, at least here in Chicago, and I'm hopeful it'll happen, you know, around the world as well.
Thanks, Alison. Thank you so much for kind of sharing your time and expertise and experiences and stories with us today. I would just, I think if people are listening to this, they won't necessarily be able to see us through this conversation. So just because of that Halloween comment, I think if people are interested to see what Dr. Alison Alwoody, Commissioner of the Chicago Department of Public Health, looks like, there's a great video with the mayor dressed as Rona Destroyer, was it? In a cape and leggings.
Yes.
On YouTube or whatever version of YouTube there is in the future, that's worth watching and brought joy in a dark time to many in Chicago.
Absolutely. Raising the news about coronavirus anytime we can. Thank you so much.
It's all about communication. Really, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks again.
Thanks.